Just last weekend, I went to the movies with my wife. There were a few decent options to choose from. There was a romantic comedy. There was a drama that got some good reviews. Or we could have gone to see the new Bond film. But I wanted it to be a perfect date night. So I took her to see a movie about car bombs blowing up neighborhoods where children are playing. I took her to see Belfast. The movie is a semi-autobiographical story based on the childhood of actor-filmmaker Kenneth Branagh in Belfast during the summer of 1969. This was a period of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland known as the Troubles. And here's a spoiler alert, the protagonist and his family ended up moving away from Belfast to escape the Troubles. And just to give the movie a particularly bleak feel, it was filmed in black and white. Maybe a rom-com would have been a better idea. Yet the film is in many ways a love letter to Belfast. Now how can you love a city where car bombs explode on busy streets where children are playing? Hello and welcome to Snapshots from Europe Travelogue. I am your host, Brian Unger, providing the historical, cultural, and geographical backstories for some of the greatest destinations in Europe to help you get a fuller appreciation for these places when you visit. Since prehistoric times, there have been four provinces in Ireland. Three of them, Connaught, Leinster, and Munster, combined to form the Republic of Ireland. The fourth of these provinces is Ulster, which we today know as Northern Ireland, and Belfast is its capital. Ulster has come to be known as a sadly contorted corner of the world. The region even sounds painful. The word Ulster seems to be a combination of ulcer and blister. Belfast has been at the heart of the sectarian violence that has plagued the region since forever. Violence, ulcer, blister. Doesn't sound like I'm doing a very good job of selling you on Belfast. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. I can honestly say that Belfast is one of the most interesting places I have seen in Europe. But before you visit, it's helpful to try to understand Belfast. How and why is the population so segregated? On the surface, it's a conflict between Catholics and Protestants, but it has never really been about faith. It's about politics and it's about power. So today we'll try to get the backstory about how this has come to be and how it all impacts on Belfast today. And to be sure, there is a lot more to the city than the sectarian unrest of the Troubles. So we'll try to make sure to highlight much of what Ulster has to offer when you visit. And I can make you a guarantee, Belfast will make an indelible impression on you. When I visited Belfast a few years ago, I had the most interesting taxi ride of my life. Our driver was a local Catholic lad. He was in his early 50s. His name was Stevie. We hired him to take us along the Antrim coast up to the Giant's Causeway. This was an all-day excursion, so I started to get to know Stevie. After bantering for an hour or so, Stevie began to loosen up. The stories became more animated, and the language was a lot more colorful. And if you've ever had any conversations with Irish people in Ireland, I think you'll know what I mean. Inevitably, the top of conversation came around to the sectarian unrest between the Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland. I asked him how this had impacted on his life, and I will never forget the story he told me. Stevie was in his mid-20s. He had just started his career as a taxi driver. One day, he picked up a young man who apparently felt that he had something to prove. Turns out he was a Protestant lad who on a dare was challenged to kill a Catholic, and he was now in the back seat of Stevie's taxi cab. With no warning whatsoever, Stevie heard a shot being fired. This was followed by excruciating pain. Stevie had been shot in the back through the driver's seat of his taxi. He slumped, bleeding over the steering wheel while the shooter fled the scene. Remarkably, the bullet missed Stevie's vital organs and he survived. He was even able to identify the shooter, who was quickly arrested and charged with attempted murder. Stevie attended the trial. He was there every day, and he was present when his assailant was convicted and sentenced to 12 years in prison. Over the years, Stevie kept an eye on his would-be killer. When he was released from prison, he joined the Ulster Volunteer Force, or the UVF. This is a paramilitary organization that's dedicated to combating Irish Catholic republicanism. These are not nice people. As it happens, there is a rival Protestant paramilitary organization in Belfast called the Ulster Defense Association, or the UDA. Also, not nice people. Now, these two organizations began feuding amongst themselves, and eventually it turned bloody. In the year 2000, Stevie's assailant became a casualty as he was murdered by a member of the rival UDA. Stevie found out about this, and he thought it would only be fitting for him to attend his funeral. He stayed until the very end, and when everyone had left, Stevie kicked away all of the flowers, and he danced on the grave of his would-be murderer. In the interest of decency, I will not repeat here what Stevie told me that he screamed at his would-be murderer as he was dancing. Although at 6 feet under, I'm pretty sure he wasn't able to hear very much. Suffice it to say, Stevie's rant was something along the lines of, "I'm up here above ground and you were down there, serves you right." You hear a story like that, and it makes this conflict seem real. It's visceral. You have to wonder, what is up with Belfast? A place where taxi drivers get shot and survivors dance on the graves of murder victims? The roots of the Protestant and Catholic differences date back to a time when Ireland was a colony of Great Britain. 400 years ago, Protestant settlers from England and Scotland were strategically planted in Catholic Ireland to help assimilate the island into the British economy. They laid claim to the most fertile land while establishing their own cultural toehold on the island. Meanwhile, the underdog Catholic Irish held strong to their Gaelic culture on their ever-diminishing, boggy, rocky farms. In 1620, the dominant English power base in London felt entitled to call both islands, Ireland as well as Britain, the British Isles on maps. By the way, this geographical label continues to irritate Irish nationalists to this day. But the Catholics far outnumbered the Protestants in Ireland, and by the beginning of the 20th century, it was clear that the sparse Protestant population would no longer be able to control the entire island. Then in 1921, Ireland won its independence after a bloody guerrilla war against British rule. There are 32 counties on the island, and 26 of them banded together to become the Irish Free State. This political entity was given dominion status in the British Commonwealth. It's similar to Canada's level of sovereignty at the time. And this was ruled from Dublin. In 1949, these 26 counties left the Commonwealth altogether and became the Republic of Ireland, severing all political ties with Britain. The population of this newly established Republic of Ireland was 94% Catholic. Meanwhile, the six remaining northeastern counties in the province of Ulster had Protestant majorities. They considered themselves to be British, not Irish, so they chose not to join the Irish Free State, and they remained part of the United Kingdom. They banded together to form the Country of Northern Ireland, but within its borders, there remained a sizable Catholic minority, a full 35% of the population. Not surprisingly, the Catholics suffered from a great deal of discrimination under the Protestant government. This disaffected Catholic group found a voice in the Irish Republican Army, or the IRA, and they wanted all 32 of Ireland's counties to be united into one Irish nation. Of course, the Protestant Unionists were eager to defend their union with Britain, and they had several groups who were representing their interests. The long-established Orange Order was one of them, and they had the military muscle of paramilitary organizations, such as the aforementioned Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, and the Ulster Defense Association, the UDA. Conflicts between Catholic and Protestant factions started to fill the headlines by the late 1960s. This became what was known as the Troubles. The Catholic minority in Northern Ireland began a non-violent struggle to combat discrimination. Partly inspired by Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in America, and the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia, and the student riots in Paris that were going on at the time, all of this was beamed into Irish living rooms by the new magic of television, and they started advocating for better jobs and better housing. Tensions mounted, and clashes with the predominantly Protestant Royal Ulster Constabulary Police became more frequent. Extremists polarized the issues, and once peaceful demonstrations became violent until the British Army was called in to keep the peace. Initially, their role was peacekeeping, but gradually they evolved into acting as muscle for the Unionist government. Then came 1972 and Bloody Sunday. On January 30th, 1972, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association sponsored a protest of internment without trial in the town of Derry, as it's known by the Nationalists, and the Unionists call that same town Londonderry. Depends where you come from and what your religious affiliation is. About 10,000 people showed up for this protest. Problem was, it technically wasn't a legal protest. British Army barricades kept them from the center of town, so they marched through the Bogside neighborhood. That afternoon, some youths rioted on the fringe of the march. An elite parachute regiment had orders to move in and make arrests. Shooting broke out, and after 25 minutes, 13 marchers were dead and 13 more were wounded. And one of those wounded would later die. That made the final death toll 14 people dead. It was the worst mass shooting in the history of Northern Ireland. By all accounts, it appeared that the army shot indiscriminately at unarmed civilians, but the soldiers claimed that they had come under attack from gunfire and nail bombs. An investigation was launched, which officially exonerated the soldiers, but it was pretty clear to everyone that it was more or less a whitewash. You've probably heard the U2 mega hit Sunday, Bloody Sunday that was released in 1983. The hard-edged lyrics captured the horror of that day. It's set to a militaristic drumbeat with a harsh guitar. It is the signature song in U2's catalog, and it's the most overtly political song in their catalog. Critics rank this as one of the best political protest songs of all time. The fallout of Bloody Sunday included an uncorking of pent-up frustration in Northern Ireland. Moderate nationalists morphed into staunch Republicans overnight, and the IRA welcomed a fresh flood of new volunteers. Conflicts continued, and by 1998, the death toll on both sides exceeded 3,000. But as the 1990s drew to a close, tensions began to simmer. Both in the United Kingdom and in Ireland, they were both members of the European Union. The economies of both were growing, and the authority of the Catholic Church and their influence over the Republic of Ireland was weakening somewhat, and it was becoming a bit less of a threat to the Unionists. All of this helped to bring about the signing of a breakthrough peace agreement. Nationalists call this the Good Friday Peace Accord, and Unionists refer to it as the Belfast Agreement. But it was a big deal. One major plank of this agreement was a pledge by the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to launch an inquiry into that Bloody Sunday massacre of 1972. It would become the longest and most expensive inquiry in British legal history. In the year 2000, political prisoners from both sides were released. And in 2005, the Irish Republican Army formally announced an end to its armed campaign when they promised to pursue peaceful democratic means as a way to achieve their goals. In turn, British Army surveillance towers in Northern Ireland cities were dismantled, and by 2007, the British Army withdrew 90% of its forces. Then, in 2010, the 12-year investigation into the events of Bloody Sunday were ready to be released. It was highly anticipated, and it was determined, reported, that the Bloody Sunday civil rights protesters were innocent. and the death of the 12 protesters were deemed unjustified. In a dramatic 2010 speech in the House of Commons, then Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, apologized to the people of Derry. He said, I quote, "What happened on Bloody Sunday was both unjustified and unreasonable. It was wrong," unquote. After 38 years, Northern Ireland's bloodiest wound could start to heal. Downtown checkpoints and quote-unquote bomb damage clearance sales are no longer commonplace in Belfast as they once were, but lingering tension still persists. This is most evident every year during marching season, which takes place from Easter till August. This is when proud Protestant Unionist Orangemen march to celebrate their Britishness, often through staunchly Catholic neighborhoods. These marches are sectarian and triumphalist, and they are meant to rub the Catholics' noses in the dominance of the Protestants. The most controversial march and most confrontational march is held every year on July 12th, and this is to celebrate the victory of Prince William of Orange's victory over the Catholic King James II at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. Wearing their V-shaped collarettes, playing music, and waving the Union Jack or Orange Order flags, the march is a deliberate provocation to the Catholics. I was in Belfast for one of these July 12th marches, and I can tell you it is quite a scene. The marching I saw was without incident, but what made an even more indelible impression on me were the bonfires. Weeks before July 12th, Unionists gathered together massive amounts of wooden pallets and tires in order to erect these enormous towers. The tricolor flag of the Republic of Ireland is placed on top, and sometimes they also attach large pictures of the Pope. These towers can be up to 100 feet tall and even higher. You wouldn't believe it. I've got pictures of this on my Instagram, Snapshots Travelogue, so you might want to pop on there and have a look. Then, the night before July 12th, this is known as the 11th night, these towers are set aflame, hence the massive bonfires. I cannot believe that these are still legal. The sectarian and ethnic hatred that these bonfires represent seems terribly offensive, but if that isn't enough to ban these things, just the fact that the pollution and environmental damage alone that creates, isn't that enough reason to ban these things? One reason that may explain why the practice has been allowed to continue all these years is that authorities are wary of the loyalist paramilitary groups who sponsor these bonfires, and they fear the threat of violence. The worst of the troubles may be behind Belfast, but these fires quite literally continue to stoke the flames. In the year 2021, there were about 250 11th night bonfires, so they're alive and well. If you happen to be in Belfast in or around July 12th, and if you're able to witness these marches or these bonfires, it is unforgettable. But if you are there at any other time of year, you can certainly still get a sense of this unique dynamic that exists in the city. The most tangible example representing tensions between the communities in Europe over the years has to have been the Berlin Wall. This was erected in 1961, dividing East and West Berlin for 28 years until it came down in 1989. Well, the Berlin Wall has nothing on Belfast, which has a wall that has been standing for much longer. In the 1920s, temporary peace walls were erected to keep warring communities apart and to choke getaway routes for perpetrators of sectarian violence. In the wake of the riots and civil unrest during the time of the Troubles, many more were built. These too were initially intended to be temporary structures, but they proved to be effective, and they've become wider, longer, more numerous, and more permanent. By the early 1990s, there were 18 of these peace walls, but they've continued to multiply. Today, there are at least 59 peace walls covering 35 kilometers. They're often up to 8 meters high, and they're constructed out of iron, brick, or steel, or a combination of all three. Some have gates that are staffed by police, They'll allow passes during the day, but at night, they're closed. When you add in other related structures such as gates and closed roads, there are 97 so-called peace lines in the city of Belfast. Statistics show that over the years, 67% of the deaths during the sectarian violence has occurred within 500 meters of one of these what are called interface structures. The walls are sometimes magnets for trouble. Kids will sometimes throw bottles over the barriers just to see if they can. Now, there is a plan in place to have these walls torn down by the year 2023, but many surveys indicate that this does not sit well with the majority of respondents. There seems to be a bit of a generational divide, as older people on both sides remain suspicious of the other. One comment I read by a local captures that sentiment. He said, quote, "There is still a lot of trauma hanging around. We've had a long period of a kind of low intensity conflict, which has left scars on the people. There's a comfort in knowing that strangers aren't going by your door," unquote. Living with these walls has been likened to living in a gated community. The neighborhood is demarcated and it gives a sense of safety to the people who live there. But the younger generation, they know nothing of the troubles firsthand, and many of them feel that the peace walls are like wartime scars, which makes them feel like they're living in a prison. The sentiment seems to be for building bonds, not walls. The most prominent peace lines in the city are in West Belfast, separating the Nationalist Falls Road area and the Unionist Shankill Road areas. When you travel to Belfast, and if you want to get a sense of this conflict, this is the best place to go. Yes, you will see the peace wall, but it's the tour of the dramatic and emotional murals of Belfast that are sure to make an impression on you. These murals are primarily about political messaging, but they're often also stunning works of art. Of course, you'll see dramatically different murals on the Protestant and Catholic parts of town. The Irish Republican areas highlight the 1981 Irish hunger strike with particular emphasis on strike leader Bobby Sands. You'll also see murals showing international solidarity with revolutionary groups around the world. Protestant Unionist communities promote Ulster Loyalist paramilitary groups, and they often memorialize with portraits that commemorate their deceased members. And you'll see the traditional themes such as William of Orange and the Battle of the Boyne. How many murals, you ask? There's more than 300. You'll see nothing like this anywhere in Europe. They are unique to Belfast and will likely be your most enduring travel memory on your visit to the city. So let's talk about how to experience all of this when you visit Belfast. Plan on at least 2 great days in Ulster to take in all of the highlights. On day 1, consider taking a taxi tour. This is the most common way to see Belfast. I'm not sure if your cabbie will have as wild of a backstory as Stevie did, but I can pretty much guarantee that your driver will be an entertaining bloke with the gift of gab, as most Irish people are, and he'll take you to all the sights worth seeing. We felt very safe as Stevie drove us through the Shankill Road area and the Falls Road area, and he showed us the Peace Wall and dozens of murals, both nationalist and unionist. He explained the significance of many of them, and he even took us to his favorite fish and chip stand where we ate with the locals. Now, if you want to learn more about the long-standing sectarian conflict, the Ulster Museum is terrific. It's got 5 floors, with the ground floor giving a balanced and thought-provoking coverage of the troubles. And there's some other pretty cool objects in the museum you might want to see. There's dinosaur skeletons, and it even has a mummy. But there's more to Belfast than just the sectarian conflicts. Besides this troubled history, Belfast is probably best known for being a titan in the shipbuilding industry. And as you may know, the largest and most famous ship in the history of mankind was launched in 1912 in Belfast. I'm talking about the RMS Titanic. The sheer size of the Titanic and her sister ship, the Olympic, which was being built at the same time, posed a major engineering challenge as no shipbuilder had ever attempted to construct any vessels this size. There were three existing slipways. They had to be demolished, and two new ones were built to accommodate these two massive ships. They were the largest slipways ever constructed up until that time. Just to launch these ships, they had to spread 22 tons of soap and tallow to lubricate the slipway. After some sea trials, the Titanic left on its maiden voyage on April 10, 1912. I think you know what happened. At 11:40 p.m. on April 14th, it struck an iceberg. The most impressive ship ever built was in service for a grand total of 5 days. Fast forward to the 21st century, when the city of Belfast saw an opportunity to capitalize on the fame and notoriety of the Titanic and its fate. A massive construction project was launched right next to the original slip where the Titanic was built. And exactly 100 years after the mighty ship sank to its watery grave, the Titanic Belfast attraction opened its doors. The project cost over $150 million to build. Just as a point of reference, the Titanic itself was built for $7.5 million. But when you visit the Belfast Titanic, you will see why it cost so much to build. The building has a very cool design. It's built in the shape of gigantic ship prows. Now, it's not really a museum. It's better to call it an attraction. It's got tons of high-tech and creative exhibits, but no actual artifacts in this attraction, out of respect for the fact that the Titanic itself is considered to be a mass grave. This attraction claims to present the world's most authentic retelling of the iconic story of the Titanic. I've been there, I visited this place, and it is very cool. And it's no surprise that this is the number one attraction in Belfast. If you happen to catch the Snapshots from Europe Travelogue episode on Edinburgh, you would remember that we spent the entire episode exploring Edinburgh's Royal Mile. Belfast has its own version of the Royal Mile. They have dubbed theirs the Golden Mile. This is a lively dining and entertainment district which stretches from the Opera House in Belfast, which is on Great Victoria Street, all the way to the university, which is on the appropriately named University Road. Along the way, you'll see the Grand Opera House, which was built in 1895. It was bombed, which is not an uncommon occurrence for prominent buildings in Belfast, and then it was rebuilt in 1993. This place is extravagantly Victorian, and it is the place to take in a concert, a play, or an opera. Right next door to the Grand Opera House is the Hotel Europa. Talking about getting bombed, this was a real target during the Troubles. It was hit 33 times, giving it the dubious distinction of being the most bombed hotel in the world. Across the street from the Hotel Europa is the museum-like Crown Liquor Saloon. This was built way back in 1849. If you wander through its mahogany, glass, and marble interior, it's like taking a trip back to the days of Queen Victoria. You head upstairs, you'll find the Crown Dining Room, which serves pub grub and is decorated with historical photos. Speaking of pub grub, doing a pub crawl in Belfast is a great idea. There are lots of different ways you can do this, but an organized tour that gets rave reviews is a musical pub crawl offered by a company called Belfast Trad Trail Tours. You'll go to three fun drinking establishments where you'll hear traditional Irish music at each pub, hence Trad Trail. You can look it up at tradtrail.com. If you haven't got a ton of time, the hop-on, hop-off bus tours in Belfast are really very good. Last time I was in Belfast, I actually did one of these tours, and it provided a convenient and efficient way to see all the city highlights. There are 19 stops on the trail. It stops at the Shankill Road wall murals, in the Titanic Quarter, St. George's Market, the Grand Opera House, the Botanic Gardens, and more. So I'm thinking that some kind of combination of a taxi tour, visiting the Ulster Museum, the Titanic Belfast exhibit, followed by an evening on the Golden Mile, taking in some Irish music in a traditional Irish pub. That's going to make a very full day for you for day one. Now let's go on to day two. What are you going to do then? Let's look farther afield. A full day taxi tour, which is what we did with Stevie, that will take you to the North Coast, and it is surprisingly affordable, and that's where the top sites in the country are easily within reach. Only 10 miles north of Belfast is Carrickfergus Castle. This was built in the year 1177 by an Anglo-Norman knight who had conquered eastern Ulster, and he used the castle as his headquarters. The castle has a very interesting history, having been besieged in turn by the Scots, the Irish, the English, and the French. William of Orange landed here in 1690 when he began his campaign against the deposed Catholic king, James II. Carrickfergus is your quintessential castle. It looks just like you think a castle should, and it is one of the best preserved medieval structures in all of Ireland. And in spite of its medieval origins, it continued to play an important military role right into the 20th century. So once you leave Carrickfergus Castle, you'll continue another 7 miles along the coast, and you'll get to the Gobbins Cliff Path. This is a complex mix of tunnel bridges, railings, and steps that have been covered, hammered, or fastened into the cliff. This was a sensation when it first opened in 1902, but it had to close in 1954 due to landslides and maintenance issues. But in 2016, the path has been renovated and reinforced, and it's reopened to the public. It's not terribly strenuous. It takes about 2 to 3 hours to hike. It's swarming with seabirds like cormorants and puffins. Puffins are my favorite. You gotta love puffins. And if you're a birder, you'll recognize many more birds there as well. From there, you'll continue north up the Antrim coast. This is one of the most spectacular drives I have ever done in my life. You imagine what Emerald Isle scenery should look like in your mind's eye? Well, the Antrim coast has this in spades. It is green and it is gorgeous. And in no time, you'll arrive at the Giant's Causeway. This is the granddaddy of all Northern Ireland attractions. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it is the most visited tourist site in the country. What you'll see here are some 37,000 bizarre hexagonal basalt columns protruding along a 5-mile stretch of coastline. One creative observer commented that it looked as if the earth were offering God a choice of 37,000 six-sided cigarettes. Geologists claim that the Giant's Causeway was formed by volcanic eruptions more than 60 million years ago. As the surface of the lava flow quickly cooled, it contracted and crystallized into honeycombed columns. However, the legend that explains the origin of the Giant's Causeway is a lot more fun. Finn McCool was a giant Ulster warrior who knew of a rival giant living across the water in Scotland. Finn built a stone bridge over to Scotland to spy on his rival when he discovered that the Scottish giant was much bigger than he was. So Finn retreated to Ireland, where he had his wife dress him up as a sleeping infant, just in time for the rival giant to come across the causeway to spy on Finn. The Scottish giant was shocked at the infant's size and quite logically surmised that whoever the father of this baby was, he must be monstrously colossal. So terrified, the Scottish giant fled back across the water. Breathing a sigh of relief, Finn tore off the baby clothes and he knocked down the bridge so he would never have to face his Scottish rival. The story must be true because to this day, this bizarre, geographical, unique rock formation extends 13 miles undersea and surfaces in Scotland's island of Staffa. You're not likely to see any giants at the Giant's Causeway, but you'll see a lot of tourists and loads of seabirds. And if you're energetic, there are some outstanding hikes you can do along the coast. Another thing you can do in the area is to visit the old Bushmills Distillery. That's less than 3 miles from the causeway. Whiskey has been made here since the 13th century, which supports the claim made by Bushmills that it is the world's oldest distillery. Disputed, but nevertheless, that is their claim. They were granted an official license by King James I in the year 1608, so it's been around for many centuries. I've done this tour of the Bushmills Distillery. It's great. It's in a very scenic, atmospheric location. And of course, afterwards, you get the obligatory whiskey tasting at the end. So what's not to like about that? The beautiful little town of Portrush is also only a short drive from Giant's Causeway, just a couple of miles, and it's a great place to have lunch. The best thing about this place is the iconic Royal Portrush Golf Course, which was host to the 2019 British Open Golf Championship. I'm a bit of a golf nut, so it was a real treat for me to wander through the clubhouse. I haven't played golf there yet, but that is definitely on my list. Portrush is also home to the ruins of Dunluce Castle, which is beautifully situated, clinging to a rocky headland. There really isn't much to see inside the castle, but if you have the time or if you're really into castles, it's definitely worth the very modest £5 admission charge. But after Carrickfergus Castle, the Goblin's Cliff Path, a beautiful coastal drive up the Antrim Coast, the Giant's Causeway, and Bushmills Distillery, you may not have the energy to explore Dunluce Castle. You might just want to slouch in the back of your taxi cab for the 1 hour drive on the direct route back to Belfast. And to pass the time, maybe your cabbie will tell you a story or two. Well, I've kind of lost track, but I'm pretty sure we've covered at least 10 things for you to see and do in and around Belfast. Ulster is truly a unique place. It is in Ireland, but politically, it is not a part of Ireland. Culturally, it is a combination of Irish and English influences that have been both its blessing and its curse. But Belfast has given the world more than you might realize. Of course, we all know about the Titanic, but many other Belfast innovations did not sink, such as the modern inflatable tire that was invented by John Boyd Dunlop, and his name lives on in the Dunlop Tire Company. How about Harry Ferguson? He invented the modern farm tractor. His name too lives on in the Massey Ferguson Company, which is one of the largest tractor manufacturers in the world. And you've got the Belfast-born physicist Lord Kelvin. Absolute temperatures are stated in units of Kelvin in his honor. And maybe the coolest thing ever to come out of Belfast was the futuristic DeLorean sports car. You must have seen Back to the Future. Who can forget Doc Brown's car? If you're into soccer at all, you'll probably know the soccer star and renowned playboy George Best, who made one of the greatest and most famous remarks of all time. He said, "I spent most of my money on liquor and women, and the rest I wasted." And of course, there's Kenneth Branagh, who wrote and directed the quasi-autobiographical movie Belfast, which we started this podcast off with. The film includes actors Kieran Hines, Jamie Dornan, and it's got music by Van Morrison. All of them are born and bred in Belfast. Too bad they couldn't also include Liam Neeson in the cast, because he hails from just outside Belfast. Because the history of Belfast is so recent and for many so raw, the place is guaranteed to make an impression on you that you won't soon forget. It sure did on me. Belfast is yet another place in Europe to add to your list. Pop onto my Instagram, Snapshots Travelogue, one word, and there you'll see some pictures of the murals, the Belfast Titanic, the Giant's Causeway, and more. I still kick myself because I never got a photo of Stevie, my cab driver. When you go to Belfast, don't make the same mistake. Be sure to get a picture of your driver, because he's sure to be a character. Well, this is the final episode for season 2 of Snapshots from Europe Travelogue. Thanks for coming along for the ride. I hope you have sensed my love of travel and my love for the 18 different European destinations that we visited over the past 20 podcasts. My hope is that perhaps I have helped to inspire you to visit some of these places. But above all, I hope that you will keep calm and travel on.